I return to the story that I mentioned earlier. The Toronto International Film Festival is facing heavy criticism after pulling a documentary about the October 7th Hamas attacks from its lineup. The film is called The Road Between Us, The Ultimate Rescue, and it tells the story of retired IDF General Noam Thibon's efforts to save his family and others during the massacre. Organizers say the withdrawal was due to the filmmakers not having legal clearance to use Hamas shot footage, even though much of it is already in the public domain. I just want to repeat this. They don't have legal clearance to use Hamas shot footage. Critics say this sets a dangerous precedent, effectively giving a terrorist organization veto power over a story that documents its own atrocities. Well, with me on the line to discuss this further is Rabbi Elchanan Popko, who is an 11th generation rabbi, author, and host of the Jewish World podcast and editor-in-chief of the new Wingate News. Rabbi, thanks so much for joining us. What was your initial reaction when you heard that the Toronto International Film Festival had withdrawn this October 7th documentary?
Well, it was very personal because I actually know Amir Thibon, who's the journalist that was in Kibbutz Neir Oz on October 7th, and he was in the safe room with his wife and two children, and he calls his father to rescue him, and it's a very personal story. He wrote a whole book about it. But the decision is clearly them being afraid of the mob that has overtaken Toronto. And they're afraid. They don't want the protests. And it's important to pay attention to this story. Thank you for bringing attention to it, because we're going to see much more of this in the coming years. You have the protesters and the troublemakers who threaten venues. You know, if you show this thing about Israel, if you show this thing that's Jewish, we're going to show up and make a scene. And they just want to avoid the headache. So they say, okay, we're just not going to make a scene and we'll quietly cancel it. And, you know, it's for us to call that out and say, no, we're not going to let it just be quiet.
I mean, my mind is absolutely blown. I don't know where to focus to ask you the questions one by one. But do you think requiring Hamas's so-called permission for footage gives legitimacy to a terrorist organization?
Unfortunately, we've seen in the past few days, even in the New York Times, Hamas being seen as some kind of a point of view or legitimate organization. We saw it on CNN yesterday, where they were saying that it's a point of view, and we saw the New York Times giving a whole feature to a Hamas terrorist. So there's more and more people in faculty, in academia, and the media who just see Hamas as another political movement and not for the terrorist organization that it is.
Okay, I'm talking to you from the United States, and the U.S. is one of those countries that has designated Hamas as a terrorist organization. How does it work then? I mean, can academia say, well, we don't care what the government says about this organization, we see it as another point of view?
Look, the U.S. administration currently is very strict on it, but they're playing a long game. And what they're doing is they're legitimizing Hamas in as many places as possible. That's why Hamas has no problem to show footage of its barbarity, what it did to having Aviatar Davida, a hostage, dig his own grave live on camera, because they know that no matter what, they will be supported. And so there's this work to legitimize them. It's long term. You're right. Yes, the State Department recognized them as a terrorist organization, but it's a push to be brazen and to just push further and further recognition of Hamas as some kind of point of view that's legitimate. And I must say, it's working spectacularly. I hope if there's a professor that's teaching marketing, I hope they teach a class on this, because the strategy so far, unfortunately, has been working extraordinarily for them.
What impact do you think pulling this film has on public understanding of the events of October the 7th?
Well, what's going to happen is they're going to show more and more films that show the side of Gaza, and they're going to show fewer and fewer films that show the side of Israel. And it's a cultural war, and it's a war to isolate Israel. There was just this morning someone who tried to make a reservation for a hotel in Spain, and they said that they have guests coming with them from Israel. So they were making a reservation for like 10 people, and two of them were from Israel. And the hotel said, sorry, you can't come here. That's their goal. The goal is to isolate Israel, to make it a pariah, and just to make sure it disappears from culture, from news, from academia. It's a war against Israel and a war against the Jews.
There are some who are arguing that the Toronto International Film Festival is just following legal protocols. Where can we draw the line, or let me say, where would you draw the line between legal caution and self-censorship?
Well, it's very easy. What they can do is they can say, okay, this particular film we have issues with, fine, we'll show a different film about October 7th. There have been probably at least 10 films made about October 7th. We Will Dance Again and others. But they won't do that, because when We Will Dance Again showed in New York, the pro-Hamas mob showed up there as well. And so they're afraid of the protests. They're afraid of the screaming and you know, disruptive people in the audience. That's what they don't want. And they cave into the mob. But, you know, Winston Churchill said an appeaser is someone who feeds the crocodile thinking that the crocodile won't eat them. And that's exactly what's going to happen.
Rabbi, in your view, what could the film festival organizers have done differently to balance legal considerations with moral responsibility?
They can first of all, they can be transparent. They can say, look, here are the lawyers we've spoken to. We've tried, but they say that it's impossible. That's one thing they could do. And like I said, they can also show different films about October 7th, which they won't because they're afraid of the mobs.
You say that you know the story of the retired IDF General Noam Tebon's efforts to save his family and others during the massacre. And of course, that was the content for the film that has been withdrawn. Knowing them, how do you think they will feel once they become aware of this decision?
Look, they are a very, very special family. I actually met Amir Tibon in Washington, D.C. When we were advocating to hold the terrorist who blew up the Sbarro pizza shop up. I'm sure you're familiar with that story, and Arnold Roth, and them trying to hold accountable the terrorist who took the life of their daughter at the Sbarro bombing. They're a family of fighters. They're a family who are, you know, been with the Zionist movement since the establishment of the State of Israel. So I don't think they're going to be fazed by this. I think they'll keep fighting. Obviously, it's a you know, backdraw, but they're fighters, and I know they'll keep fighting.
Rabbi, can you tell us a little bit about their story? The story specifically of General Noam Tibon trying to save his family, seeing that we won't be watching it at this film festival.
You know what? I looked back. You can look on Twitter and see the tweets that happened on October 7th. I looked at them in Hebrew, English, and Arabic. And what's most shocking about those hours, if you look, is how little people knew and how people assumed that the army's going to be there in a minute. I mean, you live on a kibbutz and there's 50 armed Hamas members. You're thinking to yourself, okay, I'll hold up a minute, 10 minutes, a half an hour. And that was the shock most people faced. But he didn't wait. So his son told him, look, here's the situation. Here's what's going on. He made no assumptions. He got into a car and with another very senior ranking IDF reservist, and they drove down. And what happened was, because the army had concerns that the terrorists would come all the way to Tel Aviv, they blocked many of the roads, so people who wanted to rescue couldn't go. But because he was so high ranking in the army, he just drove through and was like, sorry, I'm going in. And so he went into a war zone, armed and everything, took out a bunch of terrorists, and was able to rescue his children and grandchildren. It's really, you know, a story of extraordinary heroism.
Rabbi, you talk about what this means for academia. Obviously, my experience is in the media sphere, and I'm thinking, and I want to ask you, is it also seems to change the framework for how media are operating. We have never in the past spoken or thought about having to ask a terrorist organization, for example, Islamic State, if we are allowed to use videos of them beheading people. This is the first time that I can think of that we're actually having an argument that we need to get permission from terrorist organizations to air their footage. I mean, do you think this is going to become mainstream and actually start infiltrating the way the media operates, or do you think we're already there?
We are already there. In my opinion, it's just an excuse they found. Because like I said, they should have been more transparent, and they should have also said, okay, here's what we're going to throw instead. It's an excuse. Today it's that excuse. Tomorrow it's going to be another excuse. But they're finding excuses. I wouldn't even, you know, bother too much getting into, like, you know, should they use this law or that law? They don't want to show the movie. I know what's going on in Toronto. The pro-Hamas mobs have been intimidating everyone for, you know, almost 2 years now. They're afraid of that. It happened in New York City, but in New York, the number of Jews, when they showed We Will Dance Again about the Nova Music Festival, there were protests. I mean, can you imagine such a thing? The fact that you protest a film about the biggest massacre since the Holocaust, but that protest happened in New York, and that's what Toronto wanted to avoid.
Rabbi, just quickly, before I let you go, I just want to change track and ask you on a different topic. What's your reaction to the Justice Department's finding that George Washington University was, to quote, deliberately indifferent to anti-Semitism during last year's protests?
I am just heartbroken that it took this administration and that the other, you know, the Democratic Party, which has, you know, many, many Jewish voters, would probably not do this. It's sad for me to know that as an American Jew, my rights would not be protected under one party. It hurts me. It's just sad to see. It's a civil rights violation, and it should be not political, but unfortunately, it's been politicized, and that's very sad.
With the federal government threatening to pull funds from George Washington University unless it responds by August the 22nd, how significant is it for universities to take compliance with civil rights laws seriously?
Well, they're terrified because they saw what the administration did to Harvard and what they did to Columbia. These universities rely heavily on government funding, and so they'll do whatever it takes to get that money. I mean, Columbia got almost shut down by the government. So they know that the government is not playing around, and they will do whatever it takes to get their funding.
And UCLA has had part of its frozen funding restored by a judge. Do you see judicial intervention as a necessary check on federal overreach, or does it derail pressure to protect Jewish students?
I mean, in general, I'm not a constitutional scholar, but in general, yeah, the judiciary definitely has its role in checks and balances. But we've seen such a troubling ignoring of hate to the Jewish people in the United States, in Canada, where even judges, there was a horrific case in Montreal the other day of a father being beaten up in front of his child. They didn't even file hate crime charges. It's really, really, really disturbing, and the judicial system needs to earn the faith of the Jewish community again, because we have not seen them defending Jewish students.
One last question. Harvard, close to finalizing its $500 million settlement. What does such a massive sum tell us about the stakes involved in these anti-Semitism investigations?
The universities know that the government is after them because they've been acting with impunity for a long time. I imagine they're going to be much, much more careful. And it's good you're bringing this up because the semester is about to begin. It's been quiet. I live right near Yale University, and it's been very quiet. The universities are going to walk on eggshells, and they're going to, I know academics who are radical and extremists, and they're very belligerent to Israel and the Jewish people, and they've been silent because they know that the government would be more than happy to pull all of their funding. So I think it sends a very strong and real message. It's not just a threat. It has teeth.
And it's certainly a story we will continue to follow, probably with you, Rabbi. Rabbi Elchanan Popko, 11th generation rabbi, author, and host of the Jewish World podcast, and editor-in-chief of the new Wingate News. Rabbi, as always, thank you so much for weighing in.